You know, it's a great pleasure to be able to introduce Melvin Bragg, who's been guiding many of us through contemporary culture for several decades, actually. But what is of interest here tonight, really, is that he is also a contributor creatively to culture as well. He was born in Witton in Cumbria in 1939, where many of his works of fiction are set. He studied history at Oxford and has presented the South Bank Show for over 20 years now. As a radio and TV presenter, he lives inside a global universe, and yet his novels remain faithful to a small region of Cumbria. And like Tony Harrison and Dennis Potter, Melvin Bragg, who's actually the younger of the three, keeps returning to these roots for the work. From my reading of his work, I always feel that there's a fight going on in his fiction between staying and leaving. He's going to talk principally, I think, about the latest novel, The Soldier's Return, which, like one of his earlier novels, Crystal Rooms, is also a child's story, as well as an adult's. And I think, like Dickens, he offers two perspectives of time and place, as well as cities. The novel has echoes of Ford Madox Ford and Hemingway and many other writers who deal with this notion of war and people who come back from war into a place that is exactly the same as what it was when they left it, but they've changed, and therefore the environment, the landscape changes too. The novel draws on history. It recreates a world that has disappeared. And yet the novel also operates in terms of its own procedures, not just the procedures of history, and is a modern reevaluation, in my mind, of gender roles, male and female roles and their love, as well as childhood itself, and also principally, I think, social class. And one of the fascinating things about the book is the way that England, in a sense, is presented as a meritocracy only during the exigency of war. It's also, I should say, a very beautiful book and very moving, and I'm no way going to give away how it ends, but the last act of the novel, if you like, is quite spectacular and comes as a complete surprise. And I'm going to hand over to Melvin Bragg now, who's going to talk about this book to you. And then he's going to ask questions directly from the floor. So there will be no kind of conversation on stage. So it'll be very much up to you to ask the questions of him. Now, I can't answer for Melvin Bragg about what kind of questions he would like, obviously, but my advice would be stick with the literature. Thank you. Melvin Bragg.
Thank you very much. That was very generous. Thank you very much. I'm going to talk about this one novel. I hope by talking about it, I'll be talking about more than just a specific novel, but well, that's what I hope. What was wrong with wood? Never mind. And for about 30 minutes or so, and then if you want to ask questions, that's fine. If not, we'll talk among ourselves. I'm sure that when those of you have been to hear other writers talk, if they were trying to tell the truth of the way that they write, particularly novels, they would say as often as not that once you get the click of writing fiction and get it into your head that that's what you're going to do with the way you think about the life you want to express in writing, then stories turn up all the time. Most of them, and some of them thankfully, never get written about. But you think in terms of stories and lines and that just all the time. It becomes your preoccupation. It became my preoccupation when I was about 18 or 19. And it's like somebody obsessed with gardening, I think. I wouldn't put it any more fanciful than that. I don't think it is any more fanciful. It's an obsession, and it's a way of looking at the world. It's a way of thinking, you don't think of people as, oh, that's a good story, or she's a good character, or that. But you're always thinking about that. things are going on in fiction. You have that parallel life, if you want. That's a sort of easy phrase, and it doesn't quite express what I mean, but this is a talk and not a written piece. But that, and what's happening, actually, between novels, or even while you're writing one novel, is other novels are swirling around. Not like too many planes above Heathrow, and which one you sort of manage to call in. And I think that happens to many, many novelists, particularly prolific novelists. I mean, compared with a lot of my 18th and 19th century novelists, I'm not a prolific novelist. Compared to quite a few of my contemporaries, I am a prolific novelist. One of the things that I guess all prolific novelists share, whether they're Balzac or whoever they are, is that they write too much and rewrite too little. But this stuff keeps going on. Well, The Soldier's Return didn't start like that. It started... Is this working? It started with a specific thing, a specific event. And the event was the death of my father, almost exactly just 3 years and 1 month ago. It wasn't an unexpected death. He was 82. It happened to be an extremely painful death, but there you go. So it wasn't a shock in that sense. But I was completely shaken by it. And to a certain extent, still am. I was an only child. I was there. My mother and myself. And there are a great number of things that happen when somebody very close to you, as close as that, although we were not close in other ways, dies. And too many things to bring into this talk. Little thing, well, not so little, is that, you know, you're next. Nothing morbid about it, but the person who's been sort of out there in the vanguard or up there as the canopy is gone. And you're the next on the line. And that sort of thing. These things percolate and they inform the way you think. It actually, if it happens at a certain time, and it happened in my late 50s, as it were, happened to me, is that then it does make you feel that if you have in your work, that the only point of it really is to do what is absolutely essential. You've got to make a living and all that sort of stuff, yes, but beyond that, any playing around or going in different directions doesn't matter. What matters is that whatever there is of you to be said, and it might be that big, it might be that big, and you'd like it to be that big, but it is never going to be, so that's the way it is. Whatever's going to be said of you, the irreducible bit that you can contribute, you've got to say it now. You've just got to get down to it. Find out what it is and say it. And actually, it doesn't matter if it lasts or not. What matters is that you do it. Because that's the idea. You go to the marrow, and that's what you do. But another thing that happens, and some of you might, I would guess everybody has lost somebody close to them, because you lose the few people you lose who are close to you, they're the biggest things that, outside great hurricanes and wars and pestilences and things you can do nothing about on a personal level, the things that I would guess affect you most are the death or the life of the few people to whom you are either deeply, deeply obliged, as well as love, that's a different thing with your parents, or people you bring into your life through love or through generation. There's only about four or five, maybe half a dozen things like that ever. So this works through. And this is a poor analogy, but it might be useful to... is that it's not unlike the phantom limb syndrome, that when the arm's chopped off, there are people who... they can still feel their finger. They know the arm's there. It drives some of them crazy, actually. Some of them get very disturbed indeed. And when somebody goes, that symptom, that syndrome remains. I don't think it ever goes away. It hasn't gone away over 3 years. It dulls, but it comes back, and it's there, and it layers into your mind as part of what you are. And one further aspect of that is the conversation is finished. The conversation's over. I mean the little bits as well. You know, Tom's now, he's doing biology, and Alice has been on a protest march and all that sort of stuff. That's gone. But the bigger conversation that you're always having in your head, your parents, the things you don't bother to say, the references you make, knowing that somebody's there, even if you don't speak to them, that's gone. And that's a curious sort of pain. It's almost impossible to locate. And it's very difficult to do anything about. It's very difficult to ease it. And a great number of people in that situation write. They write for themselves, they write letters, they write notes, they sit down and just write it out. And as I'm someone who writes and publishes some of the time, as well as the other thing, this is what this book grew out of. It grew out of continuing a conversation. My conversation with my father was very complicated and difficult, and it got off to a spectacularly bad start, from which he probably never recovered. But I had a tremendous amount of admiration for him, I now realize. And by one of those cruelties of life and death, I know him better now than I knew him when he was alive. I've thought more about him and worked out, and I'm of an age now, and so on. And there were just difficulties, and he wanted me to deliver things in conversation that I couldn't because I was the time I would be exhausted, or he would be exhausted, and it was all difficult. But the conversation went on in my head, and it turned into this novel. What I wanted to do was to find as a starting point, and again, you must forgive me if I keep hesitating, because it would be easy to make it neat, and it isn't neat. It's messy, and you get there, and it turns out like this. You don't sit down and say, ah, I'm going to write a novel. Oh, it's going to be like that. It took about a year and a half for it to sort of get into any shape at all. And what I'm about to say now seems to me to be blindingly obvious, but it took me a long time to get there. That is that the novel would be set the first time that I may have known it, which would have been when I was about 6½, 7, when he came back from the war. And the three of us, my mother and he and myself, would have been together. So we would have been together, and I would have got to know him then. And that, so that was when the novel was going to be set. So I knew that. And I knew that what I'd got to bring to that was a particular emotional truth, my own emotional truth. And I think that fiction is very good about emotional truths. There's all sorts of truths. There's the truth of revelation for religious people, there's mathematical, there's truth in numbers, there's truth in our genes, and so on. But emotional truth, I think novelists, by this extraordinary combination of the finesse and the elasticity of the story, the narrative, the idea of the story in the narrative, which is completely artificial, and it seems to exist in form after form after form, whether it's science or the arts or anything, that business of the story and the invention of character, which is adjacent to but different from where its starting point is. This is not about my father and mother and me, and yet it comes out of that. This combination can deliver, I think, profound emotional truths. And I discovered that in most of the novels I really like in the past, whether it's David Copperfield, The Sons and Lovers, or The Cossacks, or whatever it is, the emotional truth of the person writing, having been through that experience and then transforming that experience into something which is different but relies completely on what happened to them, that can take you into areas that nothing else can, from my experience, and more powerful. So I got the idea and so on. It wasn't as neat as that, but I had. And I got this man coming back from the war. Well, my father was in the Air Force, so to begin fictionalizing it, I put him in the Army. If he'd been in the Army in Cumbria, he'd have been in the Border Regiment, as one or two of his brothers were. Therefore, he'd have gone to Burma. So I got him to Burma, read a lot about Burma, got that inside my head, and took him further and further and further away from my father in that simple way, which is a very great help. My mother, in the Second World War, like millions of others, went into the workforce, cleaned houses. She'd worked in a factory before then, but when she got married, she had to leave her job in the factory, as you did in that factory in those days, so on. But I displaced her by quite a lot of... For instance, she was quite interested in Labour Party politics. I mean, the Labour Party was run by women in the town in the last years of the war. I remember just going to it, and quite fun, really, playing in the chairs at the back and all that sort of stuff. But I think she was interested in keeping it going. She's a person of who believes in justice and so on, but I don't think the politics... Anyway, I took that out. It was just kind of complicated too much. And I wanted it to be simple. I wanted it to try to be a kind of a sort of everyman epic. That's what I was trying to do, and I'll stand or fall by it. It's quite a big thing to try to do, but I just wanted to clean it up, to make it as pared down and in every way, as reliant on... Or try to make ordinary language speak the way I wanted it to speak, or actually more importantly, not speak. So there's a father, mother, and a boy, and the boy was sort of based on me, except what was I when I was six and a half. And the story really is, the man comes back from the war, the boy and the mother have been together through the war, they've been sleeping in the same bed through the war, as millions of people did in this country and other countries, and I certainly did. The man comes back, this boy has to get out of the bed, get out of all of that, this man takes over, and it is expected that this will turn into a family. And everybody expects it. The child has got the father back that he's never seen. Wife has got the husband back to whom she's been faithful and wanted back, written and all that sort of thing. He's come back home. And then what happened? And that's what this novel's about, the next 9 months. Then what happened? Because especially in a located space, I used quite a few things from my own material background. We lived in a little town in Wigton up in northwest Cumbria. The whole town was riddled with what they called yards. You went down a little alleyway and there's a little yard and there'd be four or five houses, one up, one downs, with a shared tap and a shared lavatory. That's where most people live, I'd say 70-80%. So very tight little places indeed, and very heaped up on each other. Okay for two, not so good for three people. So the boy would be ripped away, and I assumed a passionate relationship between the boy and the mother when they were parted especially. And a boy of six or seven is capable of great possessive jealousy. And there are undoubtedly, as we know from Freud, erotic elements in it. I'm not talking about anything more than that, but there are. And this man coming back and finding that this child, whom he probably idealized, was a rival in many ways, in some way. And also finding this boy who was made. I mean, the Jesuits, give me the child until he's seven, and give me the boy until he's seven, and I'll give you the man. By about seven, there's a personality there. It can be blighted, it can be deformed, it can be extended, but actually, in most cases, it's there. I see for my own children and my own friends. I mean, I'm lucky I've kept friends with people I was at school with, and I see them regularly. And I think, well, William was always like that, meaning as long as I've known him, he was like that. He was always a bit daft, or he was always a bit obstinate. He's never changed. He doesn't change, does he? It's the biggest compliment you can pay in my part of the world. He doesn't change, does he? And so you've got that. And another thing that was important to me is that in this book is that what wasn't said was extraordinarily powerful. It was a time, and it wasn't just the background I came from, my class, if you want to use it, my background. It spread right across this country, and for all I know, many other countries, but I know a little bit. It was a time when you just didn't talk about the things that matter. You really didn't. You hushed up about them. The things that really mattered. I can't remember. I don't feel bad about it. I had an exceptionally productive childhood. But I can't remember anybody saying, I love you, or, I mean, even now I feel embarrassed about thinking my parents could say that to me. But let's take my father for this case. He'd been away in a war for six years or more. And all I ever got out of him, I didn't pry, which is another thing, a reason that I regret him going. I didn't question him. And I feel so stupid. I mean, I spend my professional lifetime questioning people or asking them questions, not cross-examining them. I didn't ask my own father. We talked a lot. We argued a lot. He liked arguing. And he was a thwarted man. He passed all sorts of scholarships up to the age of 14 and went down the pits because he couldn't take any of them up. But he was an intelligent man. And so we argued and talked, but I never really asked him about the war. All I know about his time in the war is one or two funny stories told against himself. That's it. My grandfather went through the First World War with six of his brothers. I've got the certificate. I just got a copy of it the other day from my father's youngest brother, my youngest uncle. From the school where they went, there was seven of them written down, seven Braggs, three Milburns, and there's about two others and two others, and they went right through the First World War, and they didn't take any leave. And one thing I knew is that my grandfather said that by the time they'd got back from the trenches up to Wigton, way in the north, there wouldn't be any time to stay there, so they didn't bother about it. So they just went a few miles behind the lines and took their leave there. But that's what I knew, that he hadn't taken any leave. And that's about all I knew. They didn't talk about it. And they didn't talk about the things that must have been tearing them apart. This man with his head full of war expected to come back to a little town and just get on with walking up street and having a pint and looking for a job in a battered little town. The mother left alone to bring up this child, fearful every day. She must have been fearful every day. A lot of the women must have. I'm people left behind. I must have been. But you didn't talk about it. She must have listened to the news every day. I, as a little boy, must have thought, of course, I only wanted to know two things. My father had shot down 100 Messerschmitts, or an announcement that Stanley Bragg had been killed. So you're between sort of fantasy and dread. But nobody talked about it. And I wanted to write a book where nobody talked about the most important things. And I found that quite hard to do, because you had to indicate they were there. And what you're relying on is the imagination, this strange ocean that no scientist I've met has much purchase on, if any purchase on at all. But it is the most extraordinary thing that allows us to empathize with something written 2,500 years ago in a different culture about people behaving in a way which we find quite extraordinary, Agamemnon or Alcestis or whoever it is, and we can sympathize and empathize and understand and extend out. Some people can understand 15 billion years ago and the Big Bang. I just can't imagine that, but some people can imagine that. And you're relying on that in a fiction. And you're relying on trying to press that imagination into gear with, in this case, a quite a small word hoard. So that's what I set out with. The attraction of this novel, when I'd started writing it, or maybe even when I finished it, was that it had other resonances, which I found very, not so much comforting, but I was pleased. One was a literary and historical resonance, that the story of someone coming back from the wars to a woman who's been waiting with her son is the beginnings of, near the beginnings of Western literature. Odysseus going back from the war in Troy, and weaving and unweaving the tapestry, and the boys being brought up there. And especially on these islands, in the last 1,000 years, I mean, 3 or 4 times a century, men have gone away to war, and they've come back or not, and the women have waited or not, and the children have grown up without the men. So I was pleased about that. I was also pleased that, not pleased, but it meant something later, that this happened to so many people in this country in the 40s. It's a ridiculous fact, but a trivial pursuit fact, but extraordinary one to try to grasp, is that after the Second World War, 4.5 million people came back to this country. 4.5 million. They came back in about 9 months. And they came back to this country. Everyone would come back to a disruption. Many outcomes were happy, I hope, and I'm sure many were. But many would necessarily be extremely difficult. And the whole islands were full of fatherless children. It often makes me smile when you read about fatherless children and what problems and so on and so forth. We were a fatherless generation. They really weren't there. That was something else that had a curious relevance for me, and it sort of helped me to think, well, maybe something's going on here. I think there are two questions that I could legitimately ask myself on your behalf, and one is why I didn't write it as an autobiography, and the other is why I didn't write it as a memoir. Well, why I didn't write it as an autobiography is because I don't trust them. I don't trust them about feelings, and I don't trust them about relationships. When I'm reading an autobiography of a thinker or a writer, I trust what they say about their thinking and their writing, particularly if I've read something that they've written, and you can test it against your own. But I think that, then he's telling the truth, his truth, not her truth, that's fine. But I don't trust them on feelings and relationships, I just don't. I think if they've got any decency, they'll want to protect certain people. And if they have got no decency, they'll want to lash out at certain people, and they want to present themselves in a good light, either by being extravagant or by being mock modest. I just don't trust it. There comes a stage in every autobiography where, even though I'm keeping reading, I'm not interested in the account of the inner life, the emotional life, because I don't believe it. I'm sure people could turn it with exceptions, but it doesn't get anywhere that I'm interested in getting. It doesn't get at the sort of truths I'm interested in finding out in the way of writing ideas. So autobiography wasn't an option. And you can, I think, by about page two, you can tell that the person's pulling their punches about parents, wives, lovers, children, by omission, or... And they are. And the people I've spoken to who've done autobiographies, they'll be very formal about it in a radio interview, and afterwards they say, well, I couldn't say that. I mean, he's still alive. And very eminent people, I'm not going to split on them because it was after the program, but it does make you worry a bit. So autobiography was out. As for memoir, well, that's quite attractive. As I understand it, what you do is you do have some clear memories, or good memories, or strong enough memories, like little bits of sunlight in a wood, and you go from one to the other. I remember that, so we'll talk about that. I don't remember all that next bit, that's a bit dark, but I remember that. So we'll talk about that. Remember that. And there's some very good memoirs. I'm still a bit suspicious about the business of Total Recall. I mean, I was talking to Frank McCourt the other month for a program I did on television, and his Angela's Ashes book, which is an excellent, relentless chronicle of his time in New York and Limerick, from a family that was even poorer than mine, which was... But what I was worried about was these wonderful conversations he had at the age of 5 and 6 and 7. I'm not being cynical about it, and I challenged him about it, as I do on the South Bank Show, very gently, because actually that's a different job from the radio. What you're trying to do is to get the artist to talk. You're the conduit, which is a completely different function. He said, well, we had no radio. We had these conversations again and again and again, and I remembered them. That's very possible. But I thought about it as a memoir, particularly as I was thinking so much more about my father. I couldn't get any purchase on it. And one of the things I did when I finished the book is that I gave it to my mother to read. Now, one or two people said, why didn't you tell her you're writing the book? Because it was maybe... And I thought two or three things. I first of all thought, well, I've never told her I was writing any other book, so I don't really see why I should start now. And secondly, it would worry her. She would think, oh, he's writing about Dad and me and himself, and that would have bothered her. And I didn't want to bother her, because I didn't know whether I was going to finish the book, how long it would take, what would happen to it. But eventually I finished it, and one or two things were happening in the book that were a bit strange. I mean, my father was called Stanley, but everybody called him Stan. The hero of this book is called Sam, and I didn't realize it well on. I know you might find it stupid that I didn't, but I didn't, that it's Sam and Stan. My mother's called Ethel, and no amount of telling her when I knew a little bit about history that Ethel, which is a great name in Saxon England, ever cured her of a distaste for this name. The woman is called Ellen in the book, so Sam and Ellen. Little things like that. So I gave her the book, and she eventually read it, and we talked a bit about it. And she told me what she thought of it, and so on. She's very tough. I mean, there's not a... it is absolutely true. It doesn't matter. She doesn't mind it. I think this is fine. There's never been a single compliment that I can remember ever. And I eventually rang her up about this book. If anybody's thinking of buying it, I mean, this is finished you for buying it. And I said, have you got it? Yes. And they're not too anxious because we talk every day. She lives on her own. She usually talks me out of the room. I say, I'm phoning from Beijing. And she says, where are you today? I said, I'm in Beijing. What's it like? Well, it's raining. It's raining here. I said, what are you doing? I said, well, we're going in the... Jean and I are going to Harrogate to see the flower show. And away she goes. And I can't stop her talking about the flower show. And I'm phoning from Beijing. And then she'll say, and then I'll say, well, that's fine. There's a crowd. She said, there was something in the Cumberland News you'd like to read. Just a minute and put the phone down. Anyway, we get through. I rang her up and I said, how's it going? She said, fine. My dad was the reader of the family, the big reader. I said, well, it's bringing back a few memories. And then I rang her up about two weeks on, quite a bit actually. I said, well, how's it going with the book? And she said, plodding along. I put the phone down after and I thought, good for you. You've never given me an inch and you're not starting now. Anyway, she finished it, and I think, and she liked it, and more importantly, people in Wickton, her friends read it and liked it, and that was fine. Then I went up to Wickton to talk about it. The first time I've ever talked about anything in Wickton. My mother, my aunts, and uncles, all there in a school hall, and I just had to tell them what it was, fiction. And anyway, so we did that. That was a booking. Anyway, so I said to her, I've written it as a novel, and she's a very intelligent woman. She had to leave school earlier, but she knows what novels are about. She knew it wasn't about her, but you get worried. Set in the same town, and I use the street names, and I'm very particular about places, and try to be as precise, and all that sort of stuff. And about the period, but then period. Anyway, so I said to her, even when Dad came back, we'd moved to Council House Yard then. You can see the level of invention on the civic part of the town I lived in. It was a nice little yard. It had a library in it, and it had the fire engine in it. It was a good little yard. And I remember my father coming around the corner. All this might be a scene from a film, but I remember it, with his kit bag and his blue uniform. My mother and I were in the door, and he's coming up the yard. And I said, well, the reason I didn't start with that in the book, and I don't, is because if I'd started with that, I'd have gone off on a different tack altogether. I would have somehow had to follow that through, and I couldn't have written the novel. That was why I didn't use anything. So I was putting away. And she said, well, it wasn't like that at all. It just wasn't. What happened was that we knew they were coming back. We got in the bus, we went to Carlisle, which is 11 miles away. It was a big railway station town, Carlisle. And I lived in Station Road at the time in Wickham. And we went to Carlisle, and the men came off the train, so we're all standing there, and your dad came up, and you didn't recognise him. And he's still looking at you. And he wanted you to recognise him. And you didn't. And then he picked you up and slung you about a bit, and we went back on the bus, and we had a good tea, and that's how he came back. Now, there are two things about that struck me. One is, I can remember quite a lot that happened to me when I was six, as quite a few people can, I'm sure. I can. I know I joined the choir when I was six, and we didn't go into it, but I know I had a lesson in church when I was six. I know I got a stone in my head, a stone fight with Jimmy Watson, because I went to the doctor's. I know I had six then. I was in Miss Moffat's class. I remember some of the things she read from the Bible to us, story of David and the story of Jesus disappearing. I remember specific things when I was six. I don't remember a thing about that. Now, I must have been wild with excitement at my father coming back. I lived in Station Road, and a big day in my life was to whip down to the station when nobody was looking, stand on the bridge and see a steam engine go through. So to go to Carlisle and see all these steam engines must have been enormous. To go to Carlisle at all on the bus, we never went to Carlisle. Wickham was 5,000 people. We had every shop we needed. You didn't go. It was extravagant. So to go to Carlisle on the bus, to meet my father, to come back, see all those trains, I didn't remember a thing. And I've since then, over the last 3 or 4 months, when is the time, June, whatever it is, I've actually sat down, not quite in a darkened room, but near enough, and tried to pull back something. Just that it can't have gone completely, but it has. So much for memoir. But one thing that really then struck me, first of all, my distrust of memoirs proved, in my case anyway, is that, and this is true, this book is full of trains. It's full of arrivals with trains, departures on trains. If there's a central dramatic incident, it happens, if there are two, that both of them happen on railway stations. It's full of trains. Well, make of that what you want, but there you go. So no memoirs, so I went from this, went to this, turned it into a novel. I set it in a specific town, because I wanted it to be set in a place. I like novels of place. That's the tradition I'm in, and I like to be in that tradition. I'm a realistic, naturalistic writer, and that's what I am. And it's an original writer, so about everything unfashionable you can get. But there it is. And so I wanted a place, and that place is Wickham. Also, I can remember, and I looked at a lot of photographs, and I can remember it enough to make it a real place, I think. And enabled me to sort of draw in not characters, I don't like characters, inverted commas, I don't do that, but make the town a place with people in it, and that moved around these three who were locked in this battle, which was going around the three of them all the time, being the three of them, changing places, anyway, whatever it is that they do. I wanted the town to be around them as a place and as a social place, and I also wanted it to be an unpreachy book. I mean, I hope it says something about society, but it certainly didn't start off intending to, and it doesn't. It doesn't say, oh, times were hard, or it was difficult, or goodness me, we had Russian books. There's nothing like that in it at all. But that's the sort of thing I wanted to make it. Of course, I did research. I found out a lot about Burma. I was helped by various people from the Burma Star organization about the terrible things that had happened out there. Read a lot of stuff. And there's only one chapter set in Burma, although some of it is threaded through the whole book, and it's crucial to the book. But I don't go on and on. I winnowed it a lot out. It's curious what memory does for you. Sometimes it helps. I began to remember one or two people in Wigton who'd been to Burma. And actually, I realized that they influenced the characters in the book, again, without me knowing it. And I can give you two examples. We had a pub by that time, by the time I'm talking about, a little pub, more or less a beer house. And in the kitchen, which was our kitchen, people came in to have a drink as well. And on Friday nights and Saturday nights, a man called George Greenup came in. And the thing that distinguished George Greenup was that he shook all the time. And you know how cruel kids can be. I was told by my father, who was a very strong man, I mean physically a very strong man, and he frightened me. I was told that if I made fun of George Greenup, he'd knock my head off. And the George Greenup shook because something terrible had happened to him. He didn't say in Burma. He probably said in the war or something. But George had been in Burma. And so, in the book, out of nowhere, as I started writing it, somebody came into the book who does crack up in a way. It does crack up in a big way. And I'm quite sure that the taproot of that, because I hadn't planned for it, it's in none of the detail of actually that's George. And there's a story about somebody with mules in this book, and because they used mules in a lot in Burma, as you know. And one of the things that we were quite proud of in Wigton was there was a book about Burma, came out in about 1951 or two. And there's a photograph in it, and the photograph said, and there's a man up to his waist in water swimming across the Irrawaddy, leading three mules. The Irrawaddy was one of the great rivers. And it said, muleteer crosses the Irrawaddy. Something like that, simple as that. But the muleteer was a man called Gilbert Little, who lived in Wigton. And we were all tremendously proud of Gilbert's photo being in this book. And I'm quite sure that fed in, curiously. So there was that sort of research. Then there was research about the time and the place. I mean, I read a lot of the Cumberland Newses for the time, just to discard. And the discarding was more important than keeping. For instance, in 1946, when the man from Burma would have come back, because they came back later, as you know, the war went on longer, there was an outbreak, a very bad outbreak of TB. My mother got TB. And there was lots in the Cumberland News, an outstandingly good local doctor was raging against it and saying, why don't you do something about it? This is what you must do about it. Get these people out of huddling together. And there was page after page of it in the Cumberland News and the Carlisle Journal. And it was very dramatic. But I thought, it's too much. It's too much for the book. I don't want him coming out of one terrible place to another place which has got a sort of another pestilence. And so it helped you as sort of what not to put in. That was useful, and there are a lot of examples there. And I looked at the films that were on and at the time, and of course Brief Encounter was on at the time. And the songs, they were a help. Cruising Down the River and I Can't Begin to Tell You and Let Bygones Be Bygones and Money is the Root of All Evil and so on and so forth. And I was rather distressed to find that I could remember the words of these songs and the tunes far better than I could remember any poetry I'd learned at the time or even after. I sang in the blooming choir week after week. And I can remember Psalm 23 and 119, but I can't remember any of them in between. But I can remember, Yes, We Have No Bananas and that sort of thing. So that helped. And another thing that helped very much was the words that came back from the war, which again I didn't flog, but it was interesting just to read them again and again, see what was fresh. Because there's Eric Partridge, there's a dictionary of forces slang and words that came back from the Second World War. Everybody knows about I'm browned off, which was as Second World War as Churchill's cigar. But the phrase he's had it, you've had it, that came back after the Second World War. It would be fresh then. Any more for any more, that was from the radio, but that came out in the Second World War. Bash, to have a bash out, I've got lists here. Carry the can, char you would expect because of the Indian connection. Get cracking, dead loss. That came in after the war, or through the war. Fair Enough came in. Have Kittens came in. And so on. Not a Sausage came in. Round the Bend came in. Swan Around came in. Right Up My Street. Just by reading these words again and again, you hope that you'd somehow pick up the feeling behind them and feel that they are both new and very plain at the time. There we are. I wrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it, and wanted to, as I said, to pare it down, try to make very straightforward words. I don't mean simple words. I mean, in Orwell's sense, very straightforward, plain words carry these meanings and hint at feelings that were not expressed, and try to do it that way. When I finished it, I found that I didn't, just to go back to my beginning to finish this part of the talk off, I didn't feel anything cathartic. I didn't feel that it had been therapeutic either. I didn't feel, oh, I've had that conversation with my father, it's okay. I felt I'd gone into a sort of a self-created world, almost sealed off from him, really. And that while I was writing it, I didn't think about him in any, as much as I have since. Since writing it, I've thought about him more and more and more. I don't talk in a more than sense. I talk in a, well, in the sense that some of you will know, that it's just, he's become part of my life. I mean, in a way that he wasn't when I was alive. And I wasn't as much part of his life, much as we both might have wanted it and liked it. And there's a great deal more that I actually know about him, not because of writing the book, but I think case of because what the book has cleared up. Anyway, that's enough. I'd be very happy to take questions, and if we're not, we can sit and talk among ourselves. Thank you very much. Of English program I'm doing about dialect. I don't use dialect in the book except once or twice. I think there's a need for standard English teaching. Briefly, yes. Otherwise, we wouldn't understand what people in Glasgow said. And they wouldn't understand what people in Keswick said. So the answer to that, yes, there is. I mean, there always has been in any community outside the community that can be almost self-sufficient, a need for either a diluted version of the language or another language so that we can communicate with each other. I mean, as a kid, we spoke much more dialect than the equivalent 11-year-olds now, and we just switched to a sort of other language at school. It was almost as dramatic as that. But yes, there isn't. Yeah, sure. Yes, because I think the dramatic evidence of war in those towns would have been tremendous. On the other hand, I was talking at the Canterbury Festival, literary festival, a few weeks ago, and the East Kents, who have fought that great battle at Kohima, of course, from around there, and in Burma. And quite a few people came up afterwards and said it was their story, even though when they're husbands had come back. How do you cope with it? The sort of emotional violence that is can't be expressed as violence, and if it is, that's another terrible rupture. I think that, you know, can happen anywhere. It would have happened in Coventry as well as anywhere else. Although the material circumstances would have been different. We weren't without the war in those little towns in Coventry. Because we were so far away, we were surrounded by prisoner of war camps. And the airfield, which was just a few miles away, was one of the principal airfields for repairing British aeroplanes, which had been badly damaged. And they literally hedgehopped up there and got repaired and then sent back to get on with it. So we were very much aware, and the things like blackout and all that sort of thing. But not the bombing, of course. That's the big difference. We weren't bombed.
I think you
could
use the keeping looking at the sound model. It's the same time. It's extremely easy to use. Well, I don't mean that in a drop. That's when I found it very easy to use. Were you conscious of trying to combine those elements?
Yeah, I wanted it to go as deep as I possibly could. I mean, I don't feel any embarrassment in saying that, because you succeed or you don't. I mean, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to try to understand and make everybody else understand. But I wanted it to be written in the language which actually paralleled the language and the sense of discussion that was possible at the time. So it just meant not making it simple, but it meant it simplifying it. And keeping it and making it plain. And, you know, I mean, most of the great lines in English literature are simple. To be or not to be, that's the question. I wandered lonely as a cloud. Millions of them, you can line them all up. They're dead simple. So simple can be okay. But I hope it's easy to read. I hope it's an easy read. Yeah. Was it later there? Now I come to my, yeah. I knew, no, I didn't plot it before. Yeah, well, I didn't plot the ending. Because I genuinely didn't know myself how it was going to end. The end is, this was very, very nicely said, the end was, I didn't plot the ending. But I knew, and I didn't plot much. I knew he'd come back, and I knew he'd have to get over this business. Being in Burma, and I knew that something terrible had happened to him in Burma. So I knew the story, but I think I'm more interested in stories than plots. So I didn't plot it out, but I knew lots of the story. I knew scenes. I knew the drowning of the kitten scene. I knew there were scenes there. They were there. They just had, I could get it right so they fit it in properly. Who are you saying?
There's a question.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's part of it. It wasn't so much class. I don't know whether I quite agree with you about class. I mean, if it comes through that way, that's fine. I mean, you read the book, you read the book. I mean, the book is read in different ways by different people. We've all got different versions of the same book in our heads. What I did borrow from my father very much so is that Sam was a very intelligent man who'd been thwarted in formal education. And he didn't feel chippy or bitter about it, although he felt a bit angry, I suppose, but the war showed him, proved to him that he could be clever. He met clever people and he could talk to them. I mean, it's better than that. So he came back just wanting not to be the same man, not to do the same job in the same way. He wanted to, aching to just find out things and know things. And how did he go about that? So that was the second dislocation Sam feels in the book. The first is, and how did these guys do it from wherever? Well, how did they go through things that they went through in Europe, the European War, and the Far East War, and come back with this all in their heads, and kind of not be encouraged to or not be able to talk about it? I look at it as something, in a way, quite heroic about them. They knew that if they let it all out, as it were, they were in terrible trouble. Because there wasn't a high maintenance care to look after them. There just wasn't. They just had to get through it. And so they just had to get through it. And that was, so he had to do that, and he had to stay in the same place, and he had to do the same thing, and that was his dislocation. He just wanted to get out and keep going. And that's what the tension of the book, as you very generously said, about that was the tension. He wants to get out, and Ellen doesn't, because she thinks survival is there, where she is, her survival and the boys. There you go. Oh, she did. Yeah, well, that's a very good compliment.
Do you ask other people who you are very close, how far do you care what they say, whether they are complimentary or not?
I care a lot what certain people think. And I care a lot what my wife thinks. There's a couple of friends. I don't send the book to the couple of friends before I've send it to the publishers, but I'd like them to think well of it. I mean, I needn't flatter or be extravagant, but I'd quite embarrassing, frankly. But I'd like them to think well of it, and I really would like them to think well of it. And slightly different reason, I like my editor to feel well of it, because she's a good editor, and also she's the person who's going to take the book from this very private stage to a very public stage. Yes. And there are some writers whose good opinion, whom I scarcely know, whose good opinion I would like. I've been very lucky with this book from critics and other writers. And that's been very nice, very pleasant. But in the end, all the writing is done on your own. It is finished before any of those views are called in. And I suppose I could have worked on it a bit, but basically it was there. I never got into the habit. I was saying earlier when with Jeremy, when we were talking to some of the students, that I wish I had had the chance in my early 20s to be taught about writing, but that didn't happen at my time. There weren't places to go. You just get on with it yourself, which I think meant that you went very slowly and you made lots and lots of mistakes, a lot of mistakes, and you learnt very slowly. And that's always a nuisance because, you know, life's short. Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether they're wisdom, but I think if you think something that you've written is as good as you can make it, then I think it would be great to get it published anywhere. I don't mean that to be disparaging. I mean, in a magazine you start up yourself. You know, just to get it out there somewhere, so you've started in some way. I'm afraid I'm going to be absolutely desperately boring in saying it is just persistence. The number of writers, that's a second thing. The number of writers who've just gone on and on and on being rejected and still gone on and on and on until they found a publisher, there's an enormous number of them. There are sort of slipways in. People who work in literary journalism, for instance, get to know publishers because it's part of the round. And when they write something, it's going to meet with an immediate reception. Not necessarily a yes, but, you know, bloke A will know bloke S B, and it'll be received, it'll be read. So that's one way in. That's a sort of faster route. But basically, it's persisting, and it's hit-and-missy. And you've got to have a bit of luck. But if you persist, you perhaps make your own luck. But it isn't a bleak prospect. It really isn't a bleak prospect. Because if you enjoy the writing, you enjoy the doing of it, that keeps you going for quite a long time. Well, good luck. In the middle there, yeah. Now I can't. Well, I hope I do, because they're great. I hope I've got all their qualities, none of their defects. You don't know what influences you. I think it's a wonderful question, but it's another talk. I would like to say that I'm influenced by Tolstoy and Wordsworth and D.H. Lawrence and Thomas Hardy and a bit of Shakespeare, but I might be influenced by The Wizard, The Rover, Women's Illustrator. I mean, I don't know. You just don't know what sort of gets in there and gets you. Look at what I remembered from the 1940s, cruising down the river. Did I remember I will lift up mine eyes under the hills? Well, I remember that, but nothing much more. I remember, yes, we have no bananas. You don't know what you remember. When I read Sons and Lovers, I had that feeling, yes, that's me. And when I read Jude, I thought, yes, that's me. But I also felt in the Cossacks, yes, that's me. And what am I to do with being a Russian aristocrat? You're going into that, do you know? You want to be like the people you... When I read the Prelude properly, when I was about 16, read it with the English teacher, who was a Yorkshireman, who was a wonderful teacher, and I realized, because I'd had a lot of troubles myself, that this was an intensely neurotic poem, and a poem about breakdowns and serious problems of focus and uncertainty, uncertainty and certainty. Then I thought, yeah, that's it. He's got it right. And there's a time in your life where one of the ways you put a tick besides what you like is if it's like you. You know, if you recognize you in it. But what you recognize yourself in is enormous. You know, I recognize myself in Isaac Bashevis Singer. Now, what have I got to do with Isaac Bashevis Singer? He to do with me. But when I'm reading it, I'm thinking, yeah, that's it, and so on. But yes, I insofar as there's a consciousness, the conscious decisions, conscious attitude at all, that Lawrence Hardy and the tradition that comes from English regional naturalistic realistic novels is one that I am in. I'm in that tradition. I mean, you know, its sizes and so on, proportionately, but that's the tradition I'm in. Yes, and and I hope, as I said, I am influenced by it. There you go. Well, that may be true. I mean, it may be true that in the actual act of writing, then things were, as it were, worked through. But I don't know whether I want it to be cathartic. I don't know whether I want a catharsis from my relationship with my father. I mean, I don't know whether I want it to be resolved. I might want it to be as difficult as it was, because it was also great at times. Something about resolution which is smooth, and I'd rather resist that, really. In fact, it's got more complicated in my head over the last 3 years, especially sort of coming up. I've got a son, and so I began to look at him in a different way and realized that I was making all the mistakes my father made and added more just for him. I think different people use them in different ways. I mean, Dickens used his childhood memories to turn out a mask that David Copperfield. Laurie Lee used it in... You can use them... I think using is... They get written about if they're strong enough. I mean, if you're writing flat out at whatever level, however good it is, or, you know, and I'm not a great writer, but I write flat out. And I want to do everything I can do. Then these things come into your mind. I don't think you go around saying, oh, that's you. But I'm saying that, and some writers do, and they're very good writers. There isn't a single answer about how a writer operates. Because every time you say, it's like this, you can think of another example. Oh, no, it's like that. I mean, Alan Bennett, for instance, I think is a very good writer. Alan makes notes all the time, and he slots them into his way. Overheard in the shop, in the street, goes down, and it's put into a play, and so that doesn't stop him being good. So you don't know, actually. You don't know. I'm going to have to bring this to a close in a moment, so if there's anything that really urgently hasn't been said, like contemporary writers, it's the most difficult writers to talk about, because you don't want to be unfair. Enters the field of autobiography. You don't want to be vicious. I've got a high regard for quite a few of my contemporaries. I like McGahan. As a novel, I mean, there's so many of them. Are we talking about poets? Some good poets around. Very good poets. Fenton, and there's a lot of good poets. I like McGahan as a novelist. I think some of Martin Amis' stuff is excellent. Really excellent. I loved McEwan short stories and one or two of the early novels. Really thought they were terrific. So I could go on, really. Philip Roth. I have that whole tradition over in America, Bellow, Roth, and whatnot. There's a great number, but that's an area that you have to slightly distance yourself from. I don't quite know why, but most writers I know do just slightly sort of distance themselves. I don't think it's only envy and jealousy, although there's bound to be a bit of that in it. I think you're just giving yourself that terrible phrase, I thought I'd never use this, it's a phrase my kids use, your own space. But it has meaning. When I use it, it has real meaning. When my children use it, it's sloppy language. But it is that. Well, thank you all very much. Thank you.